Iran has confirmed it's raising its uranium enrichment levels beyond the limits set in the 2015 nuclear deal. Senior officials also announced Tehran would keep reducing its commitments every 60 days unless other signatories to the deal move to protect it from US sanctions.
The White House responded by saying that it would continue its maximum pressure campaign on the regime until Tehran changes course. Now, this comes amid increasing tension with Iran. Last month, the Iranians shot down an American drone and President Trump nearly launched a retaliatory strike. Now, for more on all this, let's hear from Clifford May. He's a founder and president of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington. And Amin Saikal from Canberra is author of Iran Rising, The Survival and Future of the Islamic Republic. That's out now by Princeton University Press. Clifford, Amin, welcome to ABC Radio.
Thank you so much.
Clifford, help us explain the significance of Iran blowing past this low-enriched uranium threshold.
I think they're trying to up the ante. I think they're trying to tell the Europeans, you better find some way to give us some economic relief if you want us to abide by any of the restrictions of the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. And I think they're trying to give themselves as well more leverage should there be any future talks with the U.S. About Iran's nuclear weapons program.
Okay, Amin, what do you think Tehran's goal is here?
Well, I think Tehran has got two objectives. So one is to send a signal to the Europeans that they have to do more in order to compensate for the American sanctions. And the second thing is also to send a warning shot to the United States that Iran is capable of continuing resistance to American maximum pressure. And I think down of the drone and also the alleged Iranian bombing of some of the oil tankers close to the strategic Strait of Hormuz, basically to indicate to the United States that Iran has the necessary capability to cause a lot of problem if the United States continues to build up its forces in the Gulf and possibly trying to launch an attack on Iran.
Okay, and do you think the Europeans are going to help Iran out? First, Clifford.
Well, I'm not sure the Europeans can do what the rulers of the Islamic Republic want done to offset the sanctions regime that's been imposed by the U.S. I think they have been trying over time. They have a financial mechanism called INSTEX that may or may not function. I think even if it does, it won't satisfy the regime, which is feeling this intense pressure. And I think the regime is trying to decide, do we simply wait out this administration and hope for a Democrat to come into the White House in the next administration who is more likely to say the JCPOA is fine or to be more like Obama's policy.
Sure. But that's 18 months' time. That's 18 months' time, though, Clifford.
Yes. I know. Look, I think they are seriously thinking of two things, and I can't tell you what decision they've made or if they have. One is, let's run out the clock for the next 8 months. Let's see if we can get the Europeans to help us do it to relieve some of the economic strain that the sanctions have put on us. The other possibility is, let's find a way to go into negotiations. I do think that people such as Foreign Minister Javad Zarif thinks, look, I can beat these Americans in negotiations just as we beat the Obama administration negotiations. But I think they would also like that they would see it as a win, and it would be if they could get some reward simply for coming to the table rather than waiting when they come to the table and then seeing what they can give up in order to get some relief.
And Amin, what do you think? I mean, will Iran's action here prompt Europe to join Washington in sanctions?
I think the Europeans will try to resist it for as long as they can, simply because that I think the continuation of the nuclear agreement is in the interest of the European powers. And as you know, President Macron has sent one of his top advisors to Tehran in order to persuade Tehran to participate in a joint commission for resolving the nuclear dispute by the 15th of July. So we will see what's going to happen. But I do agree with the proposition that I don't think that the Europeans will be able to mitigate the effects of the sanctions on to the extent to which the Iran is really desired. But that is not really the major point for Iran at the moment. I think the regime can take care of itself. It is really the Iranian society. But then again, the regime has necessary coercive forces at its disposal and also sufficient public support behind it in order to deal with any internal disturbances which the effects of the sanctions may really cause.
Okay, now this week's news from Iran, it's clearly in response to Washington's decision to pull out of the nuclear deal. This was the Obama deal of 2015. The Trump administration pulled out last year. Clifford, I mean, was that decision by Washington wise, given that, you know, you could make the argument that Tehran is now more likely to develop nuclear weapons?
Well, my reading of the Iran deal is that it was a fatally flawed agreement. It didn't stop the Islamic Republic of Iran from going on to develop nuclear weapons. It, at best, delayed that temporarily. The sunset clause has made it very clear that within 10 to maybe 15 years of 2015, when the agreement was concluded, Iran would be essentially welcomed into the nuclear weapons club. Now, you can say, yeah, but by then, surely this would be a moderate and liberal regime. It wouldn't be a terrorist sponsor. They want to worry about their own people and getting their and being more prosperous. But there's no indications that's the case. I don't believe that is likely to be the case. So I think the sunset clauses were really a fatal flaw to this deal. Two other fatal flaws. One, their missile program. They've been continuing to develop missiles that can deliver nuclear warheads anywhere on Earth, the use of ICBMs. That's part of the nuclear weapons program. There's no other good use for it. And the third thing was that I do not agree that the verification and inspection system was at all rigorous. The Iranians made very clear, you're not going to inspect military facilities. What are the chances that nuclear weapons might be developed at military facilities? Well, very high, since they've done that in the past. And then you have, of course, the nuclear archives that were purloined by the Israeli intelligence, which shows that they still had every intention of developing nuclear weapons, although they've never said, they've never acknowledged, yes, we had a nuclear weapons program, we know they had. They've said, no, we don't really want them. But by the way, we're going to ratchet up our nuclear weapons program, the one we don't have, if you don't do what we want. So I think the JCPOA, it was a bad deal.
The Iranians have made it very clear that they do not want to cross the threshold in order to produce nuclear weapons. And the Iranian Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has repeatedly said that production of nuclear weapons is un-Islamic. That is not to say that there may have not been a secret military nuclear program. I mean, there may have been so, but at no point the Iranians were very close to producing nuclear weapons. But even now, if they increase the enrichment of their uranium to the point where they would be able to produce nuclear weapons, they would be quite a few years away from it anyway.
My guests are Amin Saikal in Canberra and Clifford May in Washington. Clifford, you mentioned that Iran is a state sponsor of terror. I'll get Amin to talk about that in a moment. But this nuclear deal clearly failed to stop Iran's regional activities of supporting these Shia militia across the broader Persian Gulf. Clifford, how can Washington, with its regional allies, stop the spread of these Iranian-backed Shia militias?
Well, the first thing that was accomplished by pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal is we're no longer financing that effort. We were giving billions of dollars to the Islamic Republic of Iran. We were, I think, hoping that they would use it again to build hospitals and schools and create jobs. But instead, as you say, the Shia militias, just a few minutes before this call, I had a Syrian-American activist here in my office. And he was explaining to me what's going on in Syria. He runs an organization that's very active there. He's had four members of his organization murdered. He says, look, Iran not only occupies Syria, it's not only part of Iranian imperialism in the region, it's colonialism as well. They are moving out Sunni populations. They are moving in Shia populations, not just Iranians, but Shias from Afghanistan, from Pakistan, from other parts of the world that have come to be part of these Shia militias. They're taking over towns. Refugees are finding out that their homes have been taken over. This is terrible stuff. We also have had, as you know, with Iranian help, over 500,000 people killed in Syria, and millions displaced. If this were happening any place else in the world, imagine what the news coverage would be and what the outrage would be. And here, the international community sort of shrugs its shoulders and yawns somehow. We've had 30 hospitals bombed in recent days. Thousands and thousands of people who no longer have medical care. These were hospitals near Idlib. They were not bombed by accident. They were bombed on purpose. And it seems to me that the international community, so-called, has no intention of forcing any sort of accountability on Tehran, even though its responsibility is absolutely clear.
And I mean, I should stress, I had the pleasure of being on the ABC's Q&A this week, and I made the point that according to Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, a lot of these Shia militias have committed appalling human rights abuses against Sunni civilians. So how worried should we be about Iran's proxies in Syria and Iraq and Yemen?
I mean, if you're sitting in Tehran and looking around to the country, I mean, outside the country, you see that it's been surrounded by hostile forces in one form or another. And what you really basically try to do that is to strengthen your deterrence and resilience. And this is what the Iranians have done, and the Iranian regime is by no means is of the democratic regime or is not involved in human rights violations or, for that matter, sponsoring particular groups in the region. But what it has really done is to build a regional security architecture which basically supports the survival of the regime and the survival of the republic. And that's why they have been very heavily involved in Iraq and Syria and Lebanon as well as Yemen.
And following on from Yaman's point, Clifford, I mean, is it rich for the US and its allies to be so hard on these Shia militias when, let's be frank, they played an important role on the ground in Iran and Syria in liberating Sunni towns from the Sunni Islamic State control?
I'm sorry, I reject the notion that the Islamic Republic of Iran has essentially taken over Lebanon through Hezbollah for defensive purposes. That they just, well, what is it that they feared from Lebanon? They feared the Christian community. They feared the Druze. I have no idea. That's not what they're doing, is trying to defend themselves. They have essentially, as I said, taken over and are colonizing Syria. They are controlling Lebanon through Hezbollah. They are supporting the Houthi militias in Yemen. And they are vying very much for influence and control in Iraq as well, supporting Hamas, of course, in Gaza. Hezbollah operates also as their proxy in Latin America, where it is teamed up with the drug cartels. This is terrible stuff. And to say, well, they're just trying to defend the regime, if all they want to do is survive, trust me, President Trump will say, fine, we'll help you survive. We'll support your survival. But what you can't do is take over all the other countries in the region and threaten them as they continue to do, threatening the Saudis, threatening the Bahrainis, threatening the Emiratis, and of course, threatening genocide of Israel. Somehow that's supposed to be just boys will be boys. Okay. It's not just boys will be boys.
Amin Cycle.
I think what Iran has been doing is the mirror image of what the United States has been doing. The United States has been trying to encircle Iran, and that's been the case over a long period of time. And also in order to contain Iran in whatever way possible. And of course, that policy of containment did not really work, and that's why President Obama decided to go for a policy of engagement, and particularly diplomatic engagement. And I think what Iran in return has been really trying to do is to encircle Israel in one form or another. The purpose of supporting Hezbollah in Lebanon is to basically make sure that there is a force which is capable of combating Israel in the event of a war between either Iran and Israel or Iran and the United States. And also the Iranian support for the Assad regime, just as horrible as that may be, and support for the militia in Iraq, and of course also segments of the Shia population in Afghanistan and as well as in Yemen. It's all for the purpose of basically trying to do what is really possible in order to respond to the American the encirclement of Iran. But let me also make this point, and I think that is very important, that it is not just Iran that has been capable of expanding its regional influence on its own, but also it's an issue of Iran being capable of exploiting important opportunities which American policy failures in the region have produced. Mm. For example, American overthrow of Saddam Hussein's regime, which really caused a mess in Iraq and opened the way for Iran to move into Iraq. American overthrow of the Taliban, which was a really good thing, but at the same time, not being able to bring peace to Afghanistan and the stability to that country, opened the way for Iran to carve a niche of influence for itself in that country. And the same really applies in the case of Syria, when the President Obama had an opportunity to really go and punish the Syrian regime, that opened the way for Iran to accelerate and increase its military activities in support of the Assad regime.
You're on RN with me, Tom Switzer. My guests are Clifford May, he's from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington, and Amin Saikal, he's the author of Iran Rising, The Survival and Future of the Islamic Republic. Clifford, how would you respond to Amin's argument that the US interventions in the Middle East, the unintended consequences have meant that the Iran Shia bloc has acquired more influence in the Persian Gulf?
There's no question there have been American mistakes, but there is no moral equivalence between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the United States of America. The United States is not trying to colonize Syria. It's not pushing out populations and taking over their homes and giving them to members of the militia. The Islamic Republic of Iran has been responsible for years for terrorism, even not just in the Middle East, but even in Europe. Some of them successful, some of them have been foiled. There was even an attempt here in Washington to blow up a restaurant with a Saudi ambassador in it at one point. All this cannot just be swept under the rug and said, well, they're kind of like the same as the U.S. The U.S. is not trying to do anything like that. So I totally reject it. That doesn't, again, the U.S. has made mistakes. And as far as Israel is not looking to take over Tehran or wipe the Islamic Republic off the face of the earth. But we do know that thanks to Iran, Hezbollah has about 150,000 missiles right now in southern Lebanon pointing at the Israelis, threatening them. We also know that the Iranians have been trying in Syria to set up their forces to have a second front. The idea is a war against Israel, a war to wipe Israel off the map, which they have talked about over the years many times, would have fronts in Syria, in Lebanon, and then, of course, in Gaza as well. This is aggression. This is imperialism. This is terrorism, and it can't be that simple.
Okay, now let's move on here. What's the best way to avoid a shooting war in the region? I mean, under President Trump, the U.S. has sent thousands of troops, an aircraft carrier, I think B-52 bombers, they've all gone to the Persian Gulf region. But remember, Trump also called off a planned military strike on Iran last month. So what's the end game here? How do you see this playing out? Amin Saikal.
Well, despite President Trump's Secretary of State and National Security Advisor aiming to secure a regime change in Iran.
This is John Bolton, past guest on Between the Lines. Go on.
So my point is that I think President Trump and his administration can really build on this in order to produce a stronger narrative. Positive narrative to the Iranians. As you know, the Iranian politics is highly factionalized. It is really the hardliners who swirl around the supreme leader, and they have the own control of most of the levels of power in Iran. And for moderates and reformists under the leadership of President Rouhani to come forward in order to negotiate or renegotiate that agreement with the United States, they will have to have more incentives in order to really sell it to the hardline factions in Iranian politics. And of course, it's not just the Iranian politics which is factionalized. I mean, look at the American politics at the moment. It's highly polarized, highly divided, and so on. And I think if the United States, for example, drop some of the harsh sanctions, that might really provide...
Yeah, Amin Saikal's not alone here, Clifford. On this program not so long ago, we've had John Mearsheimer from the University of Chicago, Stephen Wolf from Harvard. And their argument is that the U.S. should be more focused on ensuring a balance of power between the Iranian Shia bloc on the one hand and the Saudi-led Sunni bloc on the other, so that no single country is able to dominate the region. The oil will keep flowing to the oil markets. In other words, Washington should actually talk to both sides.
Well, Washington, look, first of all, Washington's willing to talk to both sides. President Trump has made that very clear, talk to the Saudis all the time. The Saudis are not trying to take over Tehran. The Saudis are not aggressive within the region. There's plenty wrong with Saudi Arabia from a human rights point of view, and it is not an emerging free and democratic country, but it's not threatening its neighbors. And Iran is threatening its neighbors, and that's very much the difference. Now, President Trump doesn't want a war. John Bolton doesn't want a war. Mike Pompeo doesn't want a war. But they also don't want the leading sponsor of terrorism, which is what Iran has been and has been designated as by the U.S. government under Democratic and Republican administrations alike, do not want that regime to have nuclear weapons and the ability to deliver them anywhere in the world. And they would like that regime to begin to at least modify its behavior.
Clifford Armin, to be continued. Thanks so much for being on RN today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Clifford May from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington. And Armin Cycle is the author of Iran Rising, The Survival and Future of the Islamic Republic. That's just out by Princeton University Press, and we'll put a link on our website. You're on RN.